Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, last week there were two events intersecting in the world of government intelligence and journalism. Washington Post columnist Dana Priest, as we mentioned before the news, won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on secret CIA prisons overseas. But also last week, Mary McCarthy, the CIA officer accused of leaking that information, was fired. We will look now at why the leak resulted in praise from one group and punishment from another, with a former CIA analyst who resigned over pre-war intelligence and its uses. Paul Piller was in charge of intelligence assessments for the Middle East and South Asia from 2000 until 2005. He's now a visiting professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University. You might remember he made a splash last month with a piece in Foreign Affairs magazine where he said the intelligence policy-making process is broken. And, of course, we'll also talk about that, and we'll ask him why he wrote that the CIA should be more like the Federal Reserve, of all things. Paul Piller, welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Could I ask you first about this Mary McCarthy case? Did you know her?
I knew Mary McCarthy, yes.
And so what do you think?
Well, one thing, her name is being bandied about in ways that apparently she and her attorney find rather offensive. I see her attorney made a statement that was reported in the press this morning that denies that she leaked things. So I think we all ought to be careful in talking about this one individual officer and this one particular leak case. But beyond that, I'd rather not try to speculate about what someone's motives are.
Well, let's say whether or not it's Mary McCarthy. Mm-hmm. Do you more admire or more disapprove of the leaking of this particular program to the Washington Post?
Disapprove. We have a system here in this country that's not like the Official Secrets Act in Britain. We have more than one category of government information. There is the great majority of it is shareable with the public, should be shareable. And then we classify other parts of it in the interest of national security. Now, we are all well aware of various ways in which questions can be raised about whether something was properly classified or should have been classified. But there are rules that exist for good reasons about not divulging classified information. And I might add, and I always have to make a sort of apology to all my friends such as yourself in the Fourth Estate who, to some extent, rely on leaks to make their living. Leaks are not a good, an orderly, or, in my judgment, a defensible way to try to provide for some kind of accountability in government. There are proper ways and improper ways to make information public that ought to be public, and doing it surreptitiously to a single journalist is not the proper way. There are damages being done. Director Goss of the CIA and others have spoken of this. For example, he has mentioned the harm that comes with regard to relations with foreign intelligence and security services. And having worked particularly on counterterrorist matters in the past, I know how heavily our government depends on the cooperation of those services. And I've had experiences when I was still in government in which I saw flows of information from foreign services cut off because previous information they had provided became the subject of a leak back here in Washington and made its way into the American press. Not surprisingly, the service would then say, no, we're not going to provide you any more information. That is a real material damage.
And yet, just last week, Dana Priest, the reporter from the Washington Post who broke this story based on those leaks, was awarded a Pulitzer Prize. So in journalism, I guess, there's the value, there's a values conflict here between what you were just saying and what is valued in journalism and is seen as in the public interest. Can you square the two?
Well, there's always going to be, you say, a values conflict. I prefer to describe it as kind of a creative tension. And I think most editors and journalists would agree with this observation. There's always going to be that tension. It's going to be unavoidable. There will be a bit of a game played all the time between government officials who know things that journalists are trying to find out and the journalists who are trying to find them out. Dana Priest is an outstanding reporter. I respect her work. I think there are many ways in which her prize was richly deserved, but that does not mean that any one officer who is still wearing the badge and has access to classified information is acting properly when feeding such information to any one reporter, whether it's Dana or someone else.
Did you ever leak anything?
No.
There are, you know, there seem to be kind of a pecking order here, where to take the classic example of the Pentagon Papers, where it's seen that at least by the journalists, that there are some cases, and I guess by the leakers even more importantly from inside, that there are some cases where it's so impossible to actually go through channels to right some kind of wrong, and it's so important to the national interest or someone's sense of right and wrong that it actually becomes the more admirable thing to do to leak. Do you think that that's never the case?
One can never say never. I mean, moral philosophers will tell you, as they have argued things like issues of conduct of war and just war, there's always going to be the extreme case. Assassinations are wrong, but would any of us not take an advantage of the opportunity to assassinate Hitler if we had that chance? The answer is always yes. That's an extreme case. It's several points about your question. One, it's, I think, always very difficult to make the case that even in the mind of a would-be leaker, that the particular instance we're dealing with is so extreme that the rules ought to be violated. I just mentioned in one case that we would all agree is extreme, but that's not the sort of thing we're talking about mm-hmm. here. Secondly, there's a slippery slope. Anytime you have individual officers taking it upon themselves to decide what's right and what's wrong with regard to divulging what is so egregious a problem that it needs to be revealed versus other things that aren't, then what happens the next piece of information that comes along that really needs to be safeguarded for good and obvious reasons? And I might add, and I think this is another point that people like Mr. Goss have very appropriately made, it's often hard for any one officer to know what all of the ramifications of a leak are, what all of the damage that can be done is. And that's why there are orderly processes for declassifying information in which all of the agencies and all of the offices that may have been involved in creating that information have a chance to say, wait a minute, what about this damage that might occur, or what about this compromise of a source? It's very rare when any one person is in a position to make that kind of judgment.
Paul Piller, my guest on WNYC. He was in charge of intelligence assessments for the Middle East and South Asia at the CIA from 2000 to 2005. He's now a visiting professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University, and he wrote that piece in Foreign Affairs magazine last month that put him squarely in the media, where he said the intelligence policymaking process is broken. We can take phone calls for Paul Piller as we go at 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. And I want to ask you more about your piece in Foreign Affairs. It really focused on the intersection between policy and intelligence analysis and how this played out in the lead up to the war in Iraq. And you say the most serious problem with intelligence now is that, quote, its relationship with the policymaking process is broken and badly needs repair. Tell us why.
If you look at the whole corpus of work that the intelligence community did relative to Iraq, it's much broader, and there are far more issues than the very, very narrow way in which it's has tended to be looked at. And by narrow way, I mean zeroing in on the specific question of weapons of mass destruction and the particular errors that, as we all know, we all widely shared with regard to what programs and what stockpiles the Saddam regime had. That was one aspect of the decision to go to war, one which the administration emphasized quite a bit. But look at all the other issues that also should have been ingredients in a decision of this importance to initiate an offensive war. One would be, sticking with the weapons of mass destruction, if he had them, if Saddam had them, would he be likely to use them? Well, as I pointed out in the article, the intelligence community offered the judgment that he would be unlikely to use them, especially against the United States, except in the extreme case of his regime being in mortal danger, as if we were invading to overthrow him. So the very action that was being contemplated and that we took was one that, in the judgment of the community, would have posed the greatest danger if he had weapons of mass destruction. Another major theme, of course, was this idea of a relationship between the Saddam regime and al-Qaeda, and there is nothing that the intelligence community ever produced that justified or that agreed with the portrayal of that relationship being an alliance, to use the president's term, At most, you had two organizations with very different orientations and goals, having some contacts in the past, but nothing even approaching a patron-client relationship or an alliance. And finally, and not least important, and we've seen the tremendous challenges that we faced in Iraq over these last 3 years, the turmoil, the insurgency, the community had some things to say about that, too, and basically that this process of trying to turn Iraq into a more liberal, more democratic place would be a long, difficult, turbulent process, that it would be characterized by a sharp conflict among the various communities, the Kurds and the Shia and the Sunni and so on, that it could take the form of guerrilla war, that the attitudes toward the coalition forces would depend most of all on their ability to see security provided and to get Iraq back on its feet economically. Of course, we haven't succeeded in doing that, and as we expected, it meant that the coalition became an object of opposition rather than support. So lots of things that should have gone into the decision, most of which were offered by the intelligence community and either misused in the sense of something like that supposed terrorist connection or simply not paid attention to at all.
So basically, most of the intelligence community did think that Saddam probably had weapons of mass destruction,
yes,
but thought he was being pretty much successfully contained and were concerned about the breakdown into the kind of war that we're seeing in Iraq now, and actually warned the administration about that, you're saying. Maybe we would have been better off if some CIA agents had leaked that to the press at the time, because I don't feel like we had that debate, really.
We did not have that debate. And there's another debate we did not have, Brian. And I think that the more recent rhetoric we've heard from the administration, although the administration has been criticized for shifting its rationale for the war after the whole weapons of mass destruction thing fell apart, as well as the, although some people cling to this, the business of an alliance with Al-Qaeda. And now we hear much more about democracy and spreading it in the Middle East and political change. My belief is that was the main motivation all along. And there are an awful lot of things the administration is trying to do more peacefully in the Middle East with that as a goal that I certainly support. I think it is important that we do what we can to promote evolution toward a more liberal, more open set of political and economic systems in the Middle East. And indeed, the administration is doing various things, such as the Middle East Partnership Initiative, which I think are working toward that goal. It was a lesson of 9/11 that we cannot ignore the internal politics and economics of that region. It can come back to hit us hard, as it did on 9/11. But an offensive war in Iraq was not the way to do it.
Do you think, and we have to take a break in a minute, then we'll take some phone calls, but do you think that the former CIA director, George Tenet, whitewashed a lot of those policy analyses that you were describing because he wanted to tell the president what the president wanted to hear?
I would prefer not to deal with any one individual because I don't think it is a matter of any one individual. I described in my article a whole climate which was created by an administration that had already, certainly by early in 2002, or at the very latest by mid-2002, made up his mind that this was the course it was going to follow, well before there were any estimates on weapons of mass destruction or many of these other things that have gotten so much attention. And if the climate in which intelligence officers, from the man at the top all the way down to the rank-and-file analyst, are operating, is one in which they know the policymaker is not searching for the best, most objective answer, no matter where the evidence would lead.
Now, we have to take a break. We'll pick it up there, and I'll also ask you about your proposal that the director of Central Intelligence actually not be appointed by the president. So we'll continue with Paul Pillar, and we'll take your phone calls for him on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Paul Pillar, who was in charge of intelligence assessments for the Middle East and South Asia from 2000 to 2005, now a visiting professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University. And you may know that he made a splash last month with a piece in Foreign Affairs magazine where he said the intelligence policymaking process is broken and that the Bush administration cherry-picked intelligence on Iraq and some other interesting things that got him into the news. And Mr. Pillar, did you want to finish a thought that you started before the break?
No, I think we covered it enough, Brian. Why don't
you
go to
the questions? And have you proposed that the Director of Central Intelligence not be appointed by the President?
No, I haven't opposed
that. I'm sorry.
And of course, we no longer have a Director of Central Intelligence. We have a Director of National Intelligence, which is a separate job from Director of CIA. No, I do not have any one reorganization scheme. We just had a reorganization, which is only barely a year old. The community, the intelligence community, is still feeling the turmoil and disruption from that. So I don't want to propose any one scheme like the 9/11 mm-hmm. Commission did. But the next time intelligence organization is revisited, and it will have to be revisited because there are all kinds of other questions about what sort of authorities Ambassador Negroponte really has and so on, this whole issue of relationship with the policymaker needs to be addressed and discussed. It was not addressed and discussed this last reorganization, which was brought about by the December 04 legislation. And my only suggestion is when it is addressed, we probably need to see the intelligence apparatus, at least the analytic part of it, moving more in the direction of the kind of quasi-autonomy that the Federal Reserve has to ensure that there would be more of a sense of independence than is the case right now when the head of intelligence serves just as much at the pleasure of the president as the head of any other department.
Let's take a phone call. Steve in Wilton, you're on WNYC. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Brian. Love your show.
Thank you
very much for taking my call. Two-part question. One is regarding Mr. Pillar, and by the way, I loved your article. A little surprised to hear, but I guess, understandable your position regarding leaking. What is your feeling then about President Bush's selectively leaking the information on the Niger matter in order to, quote, support his position? You know, is it really, since there's supposed to be an orderly declassification process, is it really proper, you know, ipso facto, the president mentions it, voila, it's declassified? I mean, is that the sort of orderly, thorough, thoughtful process that's needed? Second part relates to what Brian had asked earlier. Is there any instance where you raise the bar gets so high in terms of the public need to know, that there has to be some form of disclosure? And I take, you know, you use the extreme example of assassinating a Hitler if you had the opportunity. What about the, you know, warrantless wiretapping? Doesn't that pretty darn fundamental in my mind. Anyway.
All right. Thank you for your call. What about the warrantless wiretapping? Does that rise to that level in your opinion?
The first question that any, you know, would-be leaker is going to have to ask is, have you already really exhausted all of the channels that are, you know, some other channel besides giving a secret to an individual reporter? And on that one, and we now hear some of the history of briefings to selected members of Congress, like Senator Rockefeller, who were dissatisfied by the briefings. You know, the first thing that would have gone through my mind if I were in that situation and thought there was some information that needed to come out would be to go to the intelligence committees and seek out, say, a staff member to someone like Senator Rockefeller, the ranking member on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and ask to talk about it. And unless you can say you have exhausted those more regular, more legal, more established channels, then I don't think you've got a basis for running off to a reporter.
Though in that situation, I think Senator Rockefeller and Congresswoman Harman and some others said that while they were briefed to some degree on the programs, they could not raise it as a public issue because of the classified nature of it. So does it then become, you know, such a lockdown of anybody else having any power over it besides the administration that there becomes no other choice if somebody wants to foster a real debate?
I don't think the inadequate briefing that Ms. Harman and Senator Rockefeller and a few others got was the end of the story. And indeed, Senator Rockefeller, you know, he wrote a letter. He tried to move to the next step himself. And so I would, you know, recommend against any individual officer down in the ranks of the bureaucracy, you know, taking it on his herself or herself to try to do more than, say, ranking leading members of our oversight committees in Congress do. It's a matter of what I was getting at was, and here's a successful instance of members of Congress working their will. Goes back to the Iraq case again. That judgment I mentioned about, you know, whether Saddam would use any weapons of mass destruction if we had them, mm-hmm. that initially was not made public. It then was made public at the insistence of leading members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who said, wait a minute, we're about to have a debate here. You make this judgment. There doesn't seem to be any sensitivity about sources of, and methods. Shouldn't you make this judgment public? And as a result of dialogue between members of Congress and senior officials in the intelligence community, it was made public in the form of a letter to the from the DCI to the chairman of the committee. Now, that's the kind of procedure I'm talking about.
The caller also asked about the president's declassifying of information. Let me play a clip of Senator John Kerry on ABC This Week on Sunday referring to what he sees as a double standard.
You have somebody being fired from the CIA for allegedly telling the truth, and you have no one fired from the White House for revealing a CIA agent in order to support a lie. That underscores what's really wrong in Washington, D.C.
Do you agree with Senator Kerry's take on that?
Every leak, whoever perpetrates it, whether it's a very senior person in the White House or the NSC or some junior analyst someplace, contributes to the lack of discipline, and it's a little bit of a breakdown with regard to protecting classified information in general. So yes, I think that now famous leak that involved Mr. Libby, as alleged by the prosecutor, is damaging too. And there again, although the president has the legal right to declassify anything he wants, there are proper and formal ways to do it. And the proper and formal ways involve review by agencies that are involved and release of information to the public so all of you and in the press and everyone else can see it at the same time. It doesn't mean talking privately to a single reporter.
But in terms of what the president did, which was authorize the selective releasing of classified information or selective declassification of information, which to many people's eyes amounts to authorizing a leak. Does it amount to that in your opinion?
Well, there are two problems there. One is the fact that it is a leak. Talking privately to a reporter rather than the White House, you know, putting something on its website saying here's a government document we just declassified, now everyone can read it. I mean, that's the proper way to do it. Secondly, it gets back to this issue of cherry-picking over the Iraq war issue. I mean, here, part of the reason it was going to be this tidbit fed to one reporter was it was a tidbit that, in the view of the White House, supported their case while ignoring all the other tidbits that might have pointed in a different direction.
The Washington Post reported that there have been some changes in agency rules recently where employees are actually asked if they have any friends in the news media. Can they, should they block employment based on friendships with journalists?
Well, I don't know how far that's gone. I would hope not, because the recruitment has to be as broad as possible to get the right, most talented people. And if having friends among the press is a disqualifier, that would put a lot of good people out of consideration.
Paul Pillar, my guest on WNYC. He was in charge of intelligence assessments for the Middle East and South Asia from 2000 to 2005, now a visiting professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University, and had that piece in Foreign Affairs last month where he said the intelligence policymaking process is broken, including from before the Iraq war. And Mark in Rockland County, you're on WNYC with Paul Pillar. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Okay.
And hey, Paul, actually, the clip that you just played is goes along with what I wanted to call about. Before, Brian, when you brought up the issue of intelligence professionals being able to come forward to superiors, to go through proper channels, it's been repeatedly shown with people like Sabelle Edmonds, the translator, and a whole bunch of other longtime, veteran professionals that when they try to come forward, they are... they lose their job. They lose their security clearance. They're given psychological evaluations, and they're basically discredited to the point where there's an organization now called the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, the NSWBC, that was formed specifically because there are good people in the intelligence community who are losing their jobs because they are trying to come forward with important information. And I guess my question for Paul is, what can we do about setting up some kind of a different structure so that people who are seeing wrongdoing in the intelligence community have somewhere to go where they don't lose their livelihoods?
Well, again, I think Congress has a very important role to play here, and particularly the oversight committees. The quality of the committee's work has varied over the years. One way in which it's been very good, by the way, is keeping secrets. I don't think there's... It'd be very hard to make a case that there's been much leakage over in that direction. I cited, in response to an earlier question, an instance of a very active role played by some members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which was kind of painful for some of us who were on the other side of the witness table at the time. But I think those senators were acting quite rightly in insisting that certain judgments be made public. There's been less activity, I have to say, on the House side in recent years. But vigorous, informed oversight, particularly by those committees, is a big part of it. I had another suggestion that I mentioned in my article as a way of overcoming some of the partisanship that has plagued the work of those committees, as it's plagued so much of the other work of Congress, and that is perhaps on the specific issue of guarding against politicization of intelligence, maybe set up a new nonpartisan office, something like the Government Accountability Office or the Congressional Budget Office, on that model, but much smaller, and some involving people who have all the clearances to be a kind of watchdog on this specific set of issues, and without taking away the other important oversight roles from the intelligence committees.
Thank you for your call, Mark. And in your foreign affairs article, you pointed to the Federal Reserve as a model for perhaps restructuring of the intelligence community that might strike people as kind of a stodgy, button-down model for something you want to be really dynamic. But why the Federal Reserve?
Well, just two things in particular. It's you have a degree of semi-autonomy that's based on a chairman of the Fed and the Board of Governors that... have fixed terms and feel themselves, as they testify, at least as much responsible to the Congress as to the executive branch. The whole reason the Fed was set up the way it was, of course, almost a century ago, was for it to be somewhat independent of the day-to-day policymaking of the rest of the executive branch. I think you do need to have the Intelligence Committee part of the executive branch, but it has to be in a position that it can speak to the extent consistent with security requirements, with what I regard as its other constituencies. By that I mean the U.S. Congress and the American public, and perhaps giving it a somewhat more independent status might help to do that.
So while distance from policymakers may be needed for objectivity, which is one of the main points of your article,
right,
closeness is needed for influence. So that's a dilemma.
It is a dilemma, but as I argued there, I think it's a dilemma that's been a bit falsely conceived. I just posed the question, given all that the items I mentioned earlier in the program about the various judgments that should have made their way into decision-making on the Iraq War, but evidently were not, how much did closeness buy the intelligence community an influence on the Iraq War case? I would say very little.
How did you get into the intelligence business?
Well, I'm, Brian, right now I'm a professor. I've been, for 30 years, I consider myself an academic trapped inside a bureaucrat's body. I trained to be an academic, but this was back in the 1970s, and I had some thoughts also of, I'd like to see how things work from the inside and looking out rather than the outside looking in. And somehow, 28 years went by, and now here I am.
Did you have expertise in the Middle East or in South Asia? Do you speak the languages? Did you spend a lot of time there?
No, I am not. I am not a regional specialist by academic training or field research. I'm kind of a general international relations political scientist type, which is one reason it was very important, and certainly we placed high stress on this when I was with the National Intelligence Council these last 5 years. High stress on tapping all of the outside expertise we possibly could, professors and members of think tanks and so on, with whom we regularly consult, have them critique our draft papers, that sort of thing. And some of those judgments I mentioned earlier about the likely challenges that we would face in Iraq if we went in, those weren't unique insights that a bunch of intelligence analysts out at Langley came up with. Those reflected what I would describe as the mainstream judgments of true, genuine experts on the Middle East and Iraq with whom we consulted.
There has been debate recently about the effectiveness of the reorganization of intelligence that took effect last year. Some Republicans in particular are saying the new office of the Director of National Intelligence, above the CIA director now held by Mr. Negroponte, has the potential to be another unnecessary layer of bureaucracy that just distances the administration or the president even further from good information. What do you think about the restructuring?
Basically, I agree with that observation. Let me hasten to say that I have very high respect for Ambassador Negroponte, General Hayden, and all the others working with them who are doing the best job they can to make this thing work. But it is an extra layer of bureaucracy grafted on top of existing agencies. What happened back in 2004 was we had a commission, the 9/11 Commission, that decided to make its mark in history by coming up with a particular plan, which they sold on the basis of, you better adopt this plan or else you're not serious about counterterrorism, the you in this case being the American public and the American Congress. I think that was a mistake. It was considered in the heat of a presidential election campaign in which one presidential candidate, the one you heard quoted earlier in the show, said before he probably had even time to open up the cover of the report, let's adopt it in its entirety. And his opponent, the President Bush, then had to follow suit and say, okay, let's adopt it. So basically we had a bunch of rearrangement of the wiring diagram of the intelligence community. It did absolutely nothing to address this problem I've talked about the relationship with the policymakers. I don't think it's done anything, and I think in some ways it's hurt the counter-terrorist effort as well by just creating new stovepipes and new lines and more confusion.
Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Paul Pillar. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Professor Pillar.
Yes.
I'd be interested in your reaction to two things, a commentary by right-wing radio and even left-wing radio. Right-wing radio has been saying the former CIA agents and the retired generals critical of the Bush foreign policy. Basically, your CIA agents were just political appointees. They were put in there by the Clinton administration just to sabotage Bush for political reasons, and that the retired generals also were promoted by Clinton, but so that it's all politics. And also they're saying that Valerie Plame was just basically a clerk and not undercover. On the other hand, I heard on a left-wing station that Valerie Plame was the head of a deep undercover operation, a CIA front company called Brewster Jennings, that she was an expert on investigating WMD, and that possibly she was exposed so the Bush administration could sabotage any investigations of WMD in Iran and Iraq.
We have a minute left, Paul Pillar. Did she do that?
I guess my main response to your caller is stop listening to those right and left-wing stations and just stick with WNYC.
We'll use that in our promos from now until... But seriously, was Valerie Plame an undercover agent?
Well, I think the prosecutor, Mr. Fitzgerald, has essentially said that in his indictment, yes.
What about that Brewster Jennings thing? You're familiar with it?
No, I'm not.
And you know, Christopher Hitchens says there should be a special counsel like Patrick Fitzgerald on this new leak case. What do you think about that?
Last I heard, it hadn't even been referred to the Justice Department. That's almost a technical issue to be decided between the security officials in the intelligence community and the lawyers in the Department of Justice.
And Dana Priest from the Post has said that her two CIA sources she believes were probably Republicans, which is almost to say Mary McCarthy didn't do it.
Yeah, well, that's the one other thing I want to respond to, the first comment that your caller made.
You know what? We're coming to a break, so we'll do it after the break. Stay with us for just another minute. Paul Pillar, will finish up with him and then talk about the place of the Rebbe of the Satmars in Judaism. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll finish up here with Paul Pillar, the former director of intelligence assessments for the CIA for the Middle East and South Asia from 2000 to 2005. And you wanted to respond to the caller from before the break on, the political contributions of Mary McCarthy to the Democrats?
The general point about political preferences. So much has been written and said about, this person must be a Democrat or this person must have political reasons for taking this view. We're talking about people overall, the vast majority of them are professionals in every respect of the word. I'm talking about intelligence officers as well. I think of the retired generals who are speaking out as well. And my final thought, Brian, would be kind of a delayed additional response to your earlier question about how I got, why I got into the intelligence business. It's a wonderful place to work, and specifically the CIA, for someone who wants to deal with important national security matters and not be beholden to any one political cause, to not be in an office where half the people are political appointees. That was a real attraction to me. I think it's much still today an attraction for many of the people who work there.
Do you think it's inappropriate for Mary McCarthy or anyone else to make a contribution, if it's done while she's working as a CIA analyst, to one presidential candidate or another?
This is something that has been legally defined by the Hatch Act in terms of what's permissible and what's not. And, you know, some things you can do, like make contributions or put a placard in your lawn or a bumper sticker on your car. Other things you can't. And based on my understanding of the Hatch Act, that was perfectly legal.
All right. Paul Piller, read his article in last month's Foreign Affairs magazine. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Brian.